much for the opportunity to ask what to welcome everybody here present, honorable members, the Department of Science and Technology, EGM team, welcome once more. Our guests and presenters who are here today, and in particular those who took the opportunity that we gave for extending the deadline for submission to for those public hearings for the body itself. I think the rest of the issues we'll cover. I'm informed that in terms of the program in front of us, there's a slight amendment. We're going to have those most innovations by Mr. N. Jackson, independent consultant to CPUC, really introduce himself and his colleagues, the good doctor over here. And then we'll take biotech venture partner, Dr. Sheldon. Network support services will not be making a presentation, and then we'll take CSIR. So I'm proposing that we take the two, business innovation and biotech venture partners, take some points for clarity, some discussion, and then take the CSIR. Members, we will do that today, and hopefully break for lunch, and leave it there, because this will be the end of the presentation. And then tomorrow morning, but I'll just have to check with the department as well. We might, these members who wish, we can have a brief response from the department before lunch or even after. Tomorrow we want to start engaging this one and also taking views of members. And also the department will have extensive time to answer questions and elaborate further or look into what proposals are on the table for whatever measures that we might have to look into. And then on the 12th of February, the morning before the State of the Nation of Japan. After. Hey, I wonder how practical that is. Let's look into the practicality of that. Because after that, there will be a conference down in in the morning. Yeah, the 12th, the morning. Yeah, we want to finalize this one. That is the morning before the debate on the State of the Nation Address, not the State of the Nation Address. So hopefully we would have done everything that we need to do. So members, we can early start for you to, you'll be the first to finalize April for this year. So as the number one team, we're hoping that you'll do the country a very good thing on this mission. Thank you very much, and welcome to Mr. Jackson. Let me just give the floor to you. Currently, I believe that will become the new paradigm at this point in time.
call these houses at universities at this stage. The nature of their impact in innovation a number of GEDCO modules. Number one is that people look at that while the film CEO of General Electric Company that suggests that when the rate of change in industry are far faster than what's happening in the firm, then that can obviously send a signal that you know, one has to look at your processes in terms of your response. Number of underlying reasons that are the major causes for firms not to have the ability to be innovative. And some of those causes I found to be related to technical complexity, time to market, knowledge, formulation costs, raw material availability, and manufacturing accessibility. From recent studies as well, particularly if one looks at the Breva, May, and Roberts, that focus on the pricing negligence that's currently happening in the PVC industry, the polymer fluoride industry. We should be looking at what is the major barriers to why that sector one is an import of PVC, why that is not profitable at this point in time. Particularly if one looks at the capacity in a very hard to look at a number of modules and this specifically coming from a previous study. Thank you.
Thank you.
propose is that one should move away from only looking at patents, but one should look at protection of intellectual property in a much broader sense. Because you may find that depending on the discipline in which you are in the place, you may find that you may not necessarily want to look at patents. Particularly if one can make an example, and if you're going to look at introducing a new product that has a very small lifespan in the market, but it can become, it is a cash cow, then one should look at, for instance, rather looking at keeping it green. And so because we have an institutional framework, different R&D activities may look at different ways of protecting against intellectual property. Then the last, one of the last elements of the factory legislation towards innovation is to look at what is the government policy in place to ensure that innovation, all technology innovation, is sustainable and also it delivers the kind of objectives that it needs. And once we look at organizational strategies, when we look at advanced management techniques, when we look at organizational structures and culture, and also at the marketing structure itself. And for example, are we talking to the right people in terms of amortizing transformation? Then basically what came out of what is the proposal, specifically looking at doing innovation service at the system of higher learning, is eventually then to come up with how can you take innovation and create a culture within an institution. And what I proposed recently is looking at facilitating the institutes of higher learning and developing innovation strategies, which you call innovation of survey, establishing of a culture towards innovation with the last involved evidence, and also facilitate and drive the commercialization of innovation, and also to ensure that functionality, innovative teams, not subject to management decisions. So now this mode of running, I believe, through innovation teams will be internal collaboration. We want to look at centers of excellence and how can different R&D activities within institutions can talk to one another, etc. We want to look at interface management in terms of how to one take the innovation and how it comes within the street for others. We also want to look at business plans, ideas innovation, proof of concept, pre commercialization, and prototype commercialization. And once we go down the list, we look at the market of innovation and the transformation of this. One look at your operating risk and your financial risk. Then eventually, what I propose at this stage, we will take you through the capacity, through the measurement of the capacity of the innovation, is eventually to come up with an innovation scorecard. I believe that the next few months will become one of the most prolific documents to be come to innovation capacity. I'm currently working on this in time. And of course, the innovation scorecard will look at different performance tools that one can use to measure the ability of the enterprise or to at the end of my presentation, what is currently happening at this point in time, I fundamentally believe that by doing all these kind of good things, may still not guarantee that the enterprise will be a cash cow. And I think eventually one has to look into R&D centers and start looking at the commercialization of those R&D services. And currently, with Oscar, I'm engaged with a number of activities within the university, from health and health and wellness up to engineering, with a key focus of the commercialization of R&D services. And it's quite important that one would have to look at what is the capacity to translate innovation into commercial activities. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Jackson.
I'm not sure if there's any input from Fidenda. No. Thank you very much. I see that you've made some elaborate proposals in terms of amendments to the legislation, particularly just to give some content and meaning to some of the content. So thank you very much. Thank you very much. Members, I'm proposing that we take the next presenter and then we engage both of them at the same time. Let's take Dr. Sheehan from BioTech Venture Capital. You may sit up.
Firstly, thank you very much for the extended opportunity to present at this forum. My apologies for not being here first time around, but in reality, I don't have any issues with this forum. That necessary to present first time around, but from some of the comments that were made at that first presentation, I was encouraged to present on a particular point. And what I'm going to do is just really focus the next couple of minutes on that one clause, and that is clause 41A3. And that is the agency may, on such conditions as the board may determine, acquire any interest in any consortium or enterprise undertaking the development or exploitation of any technological innovation or invention. Now, the issue around that particular clause is the taking of an equity stake in an SME that is in an innovative part of the business. Now, if I can just take a step back and let you know where I'm in particular coming from. For the last 7 years, I've run a venture capital fund called BioVentures, or Biotech Venture Partners being the full name. And we've learned a hell of a lot over the last couple of years, literally working at the coalface with these small biotech companies that have been trying to survive in what is really a very, very harsh environment. Not just in South Africa being harsh, but globally, it is a very difficult environment for these companies to survive. And so a lot of what I'm going to say here is based on just practical learning of the last 6 or 7 years with those companies, with having a government agency invested and an equity holder in some of those companies as well. My first point was government being a shareholder or taking an equity stake at such an early stage in a company is the dilution of the entrepreneurs. Now this is a big problem even for us as venture capitalists, we're providing money and the entrepreneur wants to still own the business and not give up anything. And that's understandable, it's natural. In biotech specifically, and I cannot speak to other industries, I can only speak to biotech, the quantum of money needed take a small company from that very early seed stage right through to a commercial stage is a lot. This is much more than it would take a small company, for instance. So if the poor entrepreneur is diluted at a very early stage in its existence, that entrepreneur owns very little of the company by the time that company is ready to actually go somewhere and for the entrepreneur to start making money. And what we're seeing is harsh dilution of the entrepreneur from an early stage leaves them with such a little bit of the business that they're leaving interest. They're giving up. So I would urge any agency whose aim it is to promote SME development to find a way around diluting the entrepreneur at too early a stage in the business. My second point is the value add of government as an investor. And again, this is from experience that we've had with the Biotech Regional Innovation Centres and also with the Industrial Development Corporation. What we've seen is these agencies, however well-intentioned, do do not have the skills or the number of people needed to really add value to these investments, to sit on the board, to introduce networks, to help the entrepreneur with the business. And this is the kind of investor you want. Number one, sitting on the board, and number two, taking an equity stake. And the government, as investors, tends not to be able, however well-intentioned, to deliver that value. So again, governments diluting it, that the entrepreneur, perhaps you need the value-add investors to come in as well, which is a further dilution to the entrepreneur, so you're multiplying the effect. My third point, and this is probably the most important point, is the different mandate that a government investor would have to a private sector investor or to the entrepreneur itself. And we've seen that very much with BioVentures, where we've co-invested with the IEC, for instance. And we reach certain positions where, because of government policy, they would want the business to go in a certain direction. But we as a private sector investor, we are trying to maximize our profit. So we want to buy into this company cheaply and then sell it for as much profit as possible. And often the entrepreneur has something in between. You know, there's a personal mandate as well as trying to make some money. And those mandates, as the company develops, start splitting. And they create problems. And they cause problems between the shareholders of the company. And often the poor CEO of the company, or the original entrepreneur, spends a lot of its time trying to mediate between the shareholders. And to give you a very practical example, and we've experienced it now, where with one of the companies we've invested in, we had a very good offer from an American pharmaceutical company to purchase outright the shareholding of this company. We think it's a great idea, the price is good, but the government shareholder does not want this to happen because they see it as a loss of the South African company. And that's understandable. But we now have these different mandates in conflict with each other where, in this case, 80% of the shareholders are looking to exit the investment and make some money, and the government shareholder is holding up the sale and potentially even blocking the sale because they don't want to lose this company to South Africa. And there's no right answer to this because it's perfectly understandable that we want to keep as many of these companies in South Africa as possible. But at the same time, we need the success story where we say, wow, you know, we took this company from nothing, we've had all this money put in, some from government, some from the private sector, and look where we've taken it. To the point now where a multinational company is wanting to buy it. That is a success story, and we need those success stories. So again, this is one of the issues we face with, on a very practical level, with a differing mandate between the government, the shareholder, and the private sector. My fourth point is what we've seen from the BRICS, the Biotech Regional Innovation Centres, is often unrealistic demands on these small companies. Our government, DTI, has in particular been very clear to recognise that small companies need slightly different rules to the big companies in terms of, for instance, the Board-Based EU Act, where small companies only have to comply with 4 of the 7 criteria. To give you one example, there's talk of changing legislation around labour laws for smaller companies. There's the Employment Equity Act, which also only applies in different ways to smaller companies. So there's a clear recognition by government that smaller companies, because they're small and they need to still get going, need softer regulation. But unfortunately, what we've seen by these government agencies that are investing in these small companies is harsher regulations and harsher requirements than even the Act are requiring. But it's been a practical reality that the BRICS have been demanding full scorecard instead of the 4-point scorecard that the BBEE Act asked for. And not only that, there's requirements of, you know, the company may be sponsoring students and doing all sorts of good things which one would hope that company would eventually be able to do. but to impose those things at such an early stage when you're often dealing with a one or two person business with maybe four employees, it's very difficult. And while, you know, this act doesn't specifically outline certain things, there's, you know, as soon as it seems to be that certain organizations take an equity stake, then it develops its own kind of momentum. And my concern is by the school allowing that equity stake, we will allow the same sort of behavior that's been happening with the BRICS to perpetuate. And that behavior is actually not stimulating economic growth in the sector at all. It's having the opposite effect. The companies we've invested in now, with the way the BRICS have gone, we will not take any more money from the BRICS because of the kinds of things they're imposing on those companies. Now that puts us in a very awkward position in biotech because we're heavily reliant on the government for funding in biotech because it does require so much money. And because we only found out there was violation, we're not fully invested. So we have to go offshore for money. So we're moving offshore at an earlier stage than we would like to if we had more supportive government funding. We wouldn't have to go for that offshore route quite so quickly. The other thing is, this is just the practical experience of what happens rather than something that's specifically laid out in the bill, is all these agencies have funded projects. And this comes from the whole history of how science funding in South Africa works, where projects get funded rather than companies. So a researcher from a university would come to you to fund a particular project. And this mindset has continued into the funding of SMEs. Now this is problematic because the funder is funding a project, which is usually only one project of a number within a company, but they're taking an equity stake in the whole company. They're also only limiting their funding to that project. So they're not wanting their funding used on the day-to-day management of the business. So the entrepreneur still has to find other funding, basically to pay the rent, to pay lawyer fees, to pay an accountant, because that's not project specific. So there's also been this mismatch of how the funding's gone in and the taking of an equity stake. Another point that we've noticed with the government funders is the ability to move quickly. Now, because they're subject to GSMA, and because they have boards, and we all have boards that we're accountable for, but in the private sector, we can get our board together very quickly. Often in the government sector, you can't. You've got people spread around different provinces, and there's proper procedure to follow. We have situations where we've had companies who've run out of cash. And in biotech, this happens all the time. These companies run out of cash very quickly because the R&D is quite expensive. And you need to make a decision quite quickly on whether you're going to put more cash into that business. Now, as shareholders have something called a rights issue, where we issue more shares in the company and the current shareholders take up their rights. Now, as a private sector investor, we can move within the 21 days that a normal rights issue takes. We can move within that time, get our board approval, and put our money in that company. What we found with organizations like IDC and the BRICS, they can't move that quickly. They can't make decisions that quickly. They have structures set up, they have peer relationships, they cannot make the decisions that quickly. And this puts tremendous pressure on those businesses. And with these small businesses, you've got to be able to move quickly. And finally, the last point I make, which is actually, to a large extent, the third point, is the attractiveness of foreign investors. In trying to find exits for our investments, there are no local companies that are buying these small biotech companies or putting money into these small biotech companies. They're only offshore companies that are interested. And these companies, in looking at the shareholding structure, are saying to us, guys, we like the companies, but please get rid of these government shareholders, buy them out, do whatever you need to do to get rid of them before coming to us to purchase them. And the reason they're saying this is because of that Supreme mandate. Because they see when the government, for instance, the IDC takes the shareholding, they like to have something called minority protection, which allows them to veto sales of the company, or taking on, or issuing more shares, or raising more money, or selling a division, or selling the IT. Now, the foreign investor coming in is used to the more American and European situation. We need more companies to move quickly. You can sell a bit of IT here, you can license another bit over there, or you can sell the company quite quickly without having to go through more processes of getting your shareholder buy-in. So we've seen it as I said, a very practical reality in that we've been turned down by a number of foreign venture capital funds who were interested in the company but have asked us to try and buy out the government shareholder first. And then the current situation we have where we have a buyer who's willing to stay with us and work through the process, but that deal may not happen because we have a government shareholder who doesn't want to do this company. So from my side, it was just more, I wanted to be here just to kind of share that experience with the portfolio committee and sort of raise a warning and quite how one rewords this and that's up to you, but just raise a warning around the issue of government, particularly at the early stage, taking shareholding in SMEs. It does not stimulate SME growth. I can understand why governments might want shareholding in strategic industries, for instance, vaccines and things like that. But in an SME that's working in the pharmaceutical sector, it's not necessary. And there's many different ways that money that governments invest in the company can be protected. There's a number of different mechanisms to use that don't value shareholding, protect government's interests, but also don't stymie the growth. And as I say, in particular, this is important for biotech because we are so reliant on government money. You know, in another industry where there's a lot of money, you might say, well, fine, just don't use the government money, use the private sector money if you don't have the government conditions. But in biotech, we have to use the government money. So thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh. All right, there we are. It's yours for engagement, both the entrance presentation and this one. If there are any questions for clarity or any engagement, please let me know. Okay,
Mr. Chairman, listening to the last event, when we had this kind of a problem of the insurance business in South Africa about 10, 15 years ago, we established a credit guarantee. And Mr. Presenter said to us whether that might be a better way of doing it. In other words, government doesn't invest in the organization. It guarantees a certain amount of money to ensure that it will grow. And it only controls that money if the projects identified are being done in a certain way. Because that's what credit guarantees did to investors who invested offshore. They reinsured the insurance company that if you stay with this company whilst they are establishing a business offshore, we will also add to your insurance that company can eventually make it offshore. And I think this is something that maybe the committee should look at.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. In Mr. Jackson's presentation, he didn't deal extensively with the bill. But in the written submission, there are a number of additions and other suggestions that he made to alteration of the bill. But nothing fundamental in opposition to the bill. And so my question is he satisfied that the bill, even in its current form, creates the kind of framework and environment in which the recommendations that he makes and the concerns that he has, in fact, could be fulfilled? That's the first. And J.C. the second, in his list of recommendations, his suggestions and additions, he mentions one interesting one, the development of performance objectives and measurement to institutions of higher learning for technology innovation. Now, we are pumping millions of rand into our universities and our technicons. Is he suggesting by this proposed addition that when we give the universities money for research and development, that in fact there are no performance objectives which are established, there are no measurements against which we can judge their work? I would be interested to hear his comments on that.
As you said, mine was very much the same to Manuel Jackson as to whether he put any thought as to how one can capture this technology, you know, innovation taking place at high institutions, and whether this book effectively can influence that process, because really education, and we heard from other submissions from university academics, of, you know, of innovations which take place and get to a point, and because they're starting to make money at universities, are thrown out the window, so to speak, and I've witnessed that. But how, you know, does one now say at those institutions, you know, through this, that you need to be able to capture that technology somehow and bring it into the mixing model and approach? And then just to Dr. Sherwin, relating to, you know, she talked about there were many other ways of protecting the, you know, government shareholders, which is going to be, the, you know, one of the big issues here relating to how this full effectively will work. Besides, you know, slowing down the process through bureaucracy and such like. What other protection is there for government shareholders if they need to invest, you know, be it, or albeit very quickly, as you suggest, so that we don't lose that momentum? Maybe you could just let us know, is there other means of doing that protection, or you mentioned that there were some, maybe some legislation, I don't know, but just enlarge on that.
Thank you very much. Anyone of the suggestions can take the first one.
Now that there are current innovations, you know, right now at this point,
that actually requires very, very stringent communication strategies.
Just a comment. Firstly, the credit guarantees is a great method. It's a great way to bring in the private sector. If governments could put their money in almost as a guarantee of the principal capital that a private sector investor would put in, or guarantee the principal or part of the principal to a bank to give a biotech or an innovative SME a loan for capital equipment, that would definitely help. And government's already doing that. There's already structures in place. It's a well-known thing to do, and that's one of the things I suggest, you know, that this agency look at. How it affects, like, the writing of the bill, I'm not sure. Most of it's more the business plan of the agency, but maybe the portfolio committee can give the agency direction in this regard. The second thing is what other protection government can have, and that's pure contractual protection. Any money that is given, whether it's through a guarantee structure or whether it's a direct investment in a soft loan or a preference share or some sort of mechanism in a company, there's a contract between the government lender and the company. And that contract can have things in, like, you know, the company to report on a quarterly basis or even a monthly basis, then through the management account on a monthly basis. That company needs to institute good corporate governance. And all those things, there's no legislation needed. It's simply contractual law. It's built into a normal contract between TIA and the company that's being invested in.
Well,
the
you know how many people are going to go to jail?
Respond to that, but this is an issue that kind of countries like, for instance, Scotland is really battling with, because through their Scottish Innovation Agency, Scottish Enterprise Agency, they've funded or helped fund a number of biotech companies who've grown very large, but who've subsequently sold out to American companies. And it's an issue everyone's battling with. How do you capture some of the success and some of the progress within your own country, and particularly South Africa, where we're still at such an early stage of this? My only thing is, by keeping the companies here longer than they would otherwise be here, we're capturing more and more of the value. And as more and more of money goes into the sector, and private sector money goes into it, we're going to move down that path. But initially, we were selling innovation right from a university R&D level. BioVentures came along and we helped some of those innovations within companies for 5-6 years and then stopped. Then hopefully government money, more private sector money, you can keep those things here longer and longer. So we had lists of biotech companies. You can't eventually stop them, say, from moving to London Stock Exchange or somewhere else, but we're just capturing more and more of the value. But to prevent them from moving and being sold means a lot of them won't get started in the first place. Or they'll go right from the beginning. Yeah. So it's a difficult one. And it's one that, you know, as I said, Scotland, who's been in the biotech game for a very long time and had a couple of big listed countries, they're still backing this.
Yeah. I'm going to assist us to get out of this difficulty.
of the private and public sector interest is clashing from time to time. The point is stated from time to time, but we don't see the big one proposal and some of the proposals that came along with them together with them. My reading of this policy is that we must do this thing in the public sector. And the private sector says, yes, but leave us to do what we want with our innovation. If you want to sell, let's sell. And government says, what about the money that we should have? So I think that's the thing that we have to grapple with. And remember, we have to become very innovative in terms of how we deal with this question. I'll come back to you. Let me take you off the first focus first, Mr. Morgan, Mr. Stader, and then I'll give you the second one.
Okay, thank you, Professor. And I think from both presenters, with your presentation, where do you see us closer to South Korea, which is known as one of the centers of innovation? Do you see us going anywhere closer, or you see us this way down there? Thank you. From both of them, thank you.
Thank you
very much. Clearly she objects to the maximum role of government, or the role of government altogether. So far as this is concerned, then of course, she has motivated why she objects to that. But is there a middle of the road solution that you would like to propose, so that we do not have a total laissez-faire, as it were? And you yourself have alluded to the fact that we are not, for instance, like other economies or other countries. South Africa is pretty much a developing country, although we still talk of the first and the second economy. Meaning, therefore, that the first economy, in many respects, consists of those sections of the economy that are quite developed. And, of course, the second economy is very much underdeveloped for infrastructure and so forth. Now, in the context of the creation of the developing state, clearly the biotech industry does need government support. But what is it practically, pragmatically, that the biotech industry could do to accommodate the concerns of government as far as the bill goes, and in relation, of course, to the concerns that you have raised in your presentation?
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, but my question was also to be directed towards the department.
To Mr. Blush, why don't we take this proposal to the country? Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
certainly all your management performance statistics and your analysis measures of performance. Certainly, that is one of the reasons why I perhaps have to conclude that those of performance measures. But certainly, the goal does promote a less regulation for me.
Okay, I'm no expert on South Korea, I'm afraid, but all I know about it is that South Korea would not have got to where it did without very strong government leadership to make it such an innovative country. And we've seen such leadership from this government in pushing innovation very hard. So I think we are getting closer to that. The specific mechanisms they use would probably not be able to be used here because of the different structure of the economy. But I think with a strong government leadership pushing innovation, that will get us a lot closer to being an innovative country like North Korea. And then to just respond to the second gentleman there, I do support government intervention in the sector. I think it's necessary. I do support government support of the sector. And in fact, I support this book because I think it's great that all the different current disparate things that are happening with the BRICS and with the Innovation Fund are all brought under one roof. I think that's a very good thing. How one finds that middle of the road between the pure kind of capitalist sector and the public interest sector is very difficult. I don't think anyone's got the right answer. My best suggestion is that when the business plan of CHEER gets developed, that both sectors sit down and kind of try and thresh out that middle ground. But in order to get a biotech industry going, we need to support the SMEs, and we need to put in as much in place to support those SMEs as possible. That would be my only comment to that. I don't know the answer. It's unfortunately not one that's simple. As you alluded to it too, you know, government money is going into for a purpose, private sector is just trying to make money. It's tricky.
Thanks,
Ben.
Well, he just has the EGM team to respond to some of the issues like this, as a matter of fact, in Russian.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I would just like to ask the department whether they have even thought to the credit guarantee bill, because the concept of the credit guarantee bill is really to allow insurance companies who take risks to take those risks. Whereas government cannot take the risk, and I would very much like them to go and explore it before we finalize this all to see whether we cannot learn maybe something from the Department of State and Industry as far as this thing is concerned. Let me give you a bit of the history of the bill. When we developed the bill, and I think it was developed some 15, 20 years ago by government, it opened up doors for the smaller business sectors like SPAR and other organizations such as that to go into Africa and explore the market there and establish themselves in Africa. And if you look at SPAR and all those companies nowadays, you really see how that helped us through the Credit Guarantee Act that was done. Because that was the organization government put aside with billions of rand to take those risks. And I think this is something our department should go and investigate and come back before we finalize the model.
I just want to take up some words my colleague left us with. From all accounts, and you know, hearing today again from Dr. Sheeran, the biggest problem that we're going to face with this is the whole aspect of how it's going to be funded and whether, in fact, those funds are going to be directed into equities or shares in companies, etc. Which uses primarily in access to CSMA, and I think in particular, the CSR, I think, brought that particular issue up. Now, I would like to propose, Chair, that we actually, you know, have a look at some of those implications, because they are serious implications, particularly if you look at it in its, you know, in the present form, because it will mean that for a start, under the present sort of act, that the CIA, be it established or not as an agency, will not be able to do these taxing, but anyway, any surpluses that might be accrued, you must be taxed as well in terms of the tax. So really, it doesn't give the incentive for them to be profit orientated in a sense. So, you know, this application that was suggested for it to be classified as a 3D is paramount to this whole exercise. Otherwise, you're going to become lame duck. It's going to be a agency sitting here doing absolutely sweet nothing, because every time it lends, it's either going to be too late because of the processes that it has to go through or needs to go through in terms of the, you know, the bureaucracy needs to appear in the face. Or alternatively, if it does give money out and does get it into some sort of equity and there's profits that are going to be realized, you know, how do you deal with those businesses in terms of that? So I think this is a very crucial thing that's been brought up by not only Dr. Sherwin but many other speakers here, that we get this thing sorted out before we move any. Otherwise, this is going to be what I said, a landmark.
Thank you very much. Quite interesting.
Very exciting.
Did you want to throw in your
comment? Thanks, Chair. I think I'll try and respond to the suggestion by the Honourable Islam Chair that maybe we should look at this credit card CPA. We haven't looked at this again, as we did last time. We're here for the whole of today and tomorrow, so we have a whole night ahead of us, so we can see in our response that it is tomorrow we will have, and whether we can share, I think, our interpretation. The other issues that have been raised, I would rather just to remind colleagues, without being specific to the response, because we will do that tomorrow, is the original intent of this bill, which is to bridge the innovation curve, which is to create high-tech industries in South Africa, located in South Africa, having job creation in South Africa, having a factory that will generate the revenue. And sadly, to remind ourselves again, we made this point last time, that we would like intervention to be looked at in relation to where you are in the innovation chain. The intervention, if we are moving from members of the portfolio committee now know, from the left-hand side of the innovation chain to the right-hand side are different than when you move from an existing business that you take 30 months. Some of these interventions, I'm not talking about research that is being done and there is no existing company. And we want to make sure that we add value to the IP that is generated by that consortium or that industry to a point where the value of the IP is high enough for you to be able to either sell it to somebody or to license it so that you can generate the value. So I'd like us to keep those objectives at the back of our mind. And remember that this is a bill and it's not a regulation. We can go to some of the details of what we are measured to do. And then lastly, it's nice to know the experiences of how the BRICS and Innovation Fund have worked, but the TIA is not the regulation. So those are the quick comments.
Thank you. I think there
were
this discomfort about the BRICS because the government funding. And they say the attitude of carbon is not changing. So let's take it in that form. But here, yes, there's a different situation. So I want us to stop there. For the presentation. And thank you very much for your time and your valuable input. I want to take here by heart. I'm so little guilty. So if you want some water or juice, go there, sit down, take that. We only pay for lunch at the particular time, and lunch is the same. Hold assembly, I will take you there. If you don't pay, let's start 30 or 1 o'clock, depending on what the first time is. CSIR is setting its staff equipment. Members have received their input. I did check what CSIR is on that report. There is a page 2 that is not the financial report, the holding company, or did the director select a job? Because we knew that they were looking to that. You call it.
Thank you, Chair and honourable members of the portfolio committee. I've come here today just to pick up on the issue that was raised at the last meeting. But just before I do, I just make the point that this slide is just an overview of a document that has been distributed to everybody. And I know that the time frame between distribution and the meeting are very short, so I will emphasize some of the points in that formal three-page document that was sent to you. I think the first point that I want to make is that I'm very encouraged by the positive discussion yesterday. I think everybody's saying the same thing, that there is a need for this act. No one's disputing that. And some of the issues that have been raised more about implementation matters, operational matters, and not the actual wording of the act itself. There are one or two sort of fundamental issues that have been, but I think those are related ones to the share mission. But I think we must remember that there was an act almost identical to this in place all this time. The Department of Science and Technology chose to, for technical reasons, put in place a new act instead of commending the existing act. I think the existing act comes from a time when the national system of innovation was quite different, and you know, I refer you there to the last comments I make in the written report that was submitted. CYCLE was formed and housed in CSR originally, and at that stage, CSR was the logical owner of such a national entity. Since then, however, the entity's funding sources and nature of funding mechanisms have changed. We have innovation funds, we have BRICS, we have all sorts of initiatives designed to support innovation. And we think it is entirely logical that an entity like here is formed and brought into being as a matter of urgency to house all of that. I think the point of putting in place a new act as opposed to changing the existing act has premise in it. One of the points in the existing act was that CSR can be a shareholder in CYCLE, and they very late in technically changes that may have been required, and instead he is chosen to go to the putting in place a new act. And that point of the CSR being the only permissible shareholder is in fact fundamental to what we were setting yesterday in explanation in response to the question raised last time, which was what happens to the assets of CYCLE and its subsidiaries. The chairperson asked for some overview as opposed to some historic picture as opposed to just directly focusing on the balance sheet. And so I've just chosen to reflect on what happened in the time CYCLE. In 1962 it was formed, and if you look at the Act, Section 10, 1A sets out the fact that shares were allotted initially in 62. But then between 1984 and 1988, that original capital had been reduced. Ventures with IT investments,
terms of this section 10.1a, subsection 4, lent another 22 million rand. Now, at that point in time, Sidecore, simultaneously to a particular event, information of technical, Sidecore transferred assets to technicians. They transferred all the entire IT portfolio issues and sensitive assets. IDT became a 50% shareholder in technical ability. Technical was actually a shelf company that had been formed by IDT. So DTI put in the 32 million. And they chose to interpose IDT as a shareholder in this company that was now going to own the assets that came from the company. So in that clause, section 10.3, that therein lays the reason for the structure coming into being. Only the research council is capable of becoming a shareholder in the corporation. And at that stage, it's clear that the government department involved decided it's too complex to contest that. Let's put in place this company called Technica, which is 100% subsidiary, a 50% subsidiary of Cycle, and in which the IT ended up owning 50%. And simultaneous to that, then, DBI converted the loan to Cycle to share capital. So that given that 22 million over that 4-year period, converted it to place for 50% owning. And in CSR, this is section 10.4, that loan is converted to share capital and ended up putting 100% in Cycle, which is doing. Then, in 1996, IDC had discussions where they decided that they didn't really understand this 30-stage venture business as well, and they wanted to withdraw. They then were issued temporarily a 1A class share, and in place of that, CSR undertook to refund, according to a certain formula, their share capital and loan capital, which happened over the next 5 years, and it was a closing of the books over the next 5 years. So the net result of all of that is that since 1996, CSR has had 100% of the share capital in Cycle, which has 100% of the share capital in Technical, and that entire share portfolio, IT portfolio, is in effect reported in the CSR consolidated American Station. I think that's a very important point because there was a sort of up to this last week around what happens to the accountability for those assets, what happens to those assets in the case. What has happened now, as pointed out in this report, is that technically speaking, out of time, it is 100% share of CSR now, and that portfolio is made subject. That's a lot. Since 1996, it has been reported in performance terms, in governance terms, in terms of accountability to the portfolio committee, in as part and parcel of the CSR consolidation. Okay, that's in short and sweet the explanation for the question that you raised.
Thank you very much. Members, there we are. Any engagement?
Can I just say a clarity? I didn't quite catch your initial comment between 1962 up to 1984. You said various, I thought you said various investments have been made by the institution. Yes. And investments in what? So where are those investments today? What is the state of those investments? What are they and what is their extent?
The essence of the investment is the essence of the investment of it. And those statements in those days probably could be 100,000 rand per family of patients that were invested in. At the time, time that IDC became the shareholder in Technicon, all the patents were signed from Cycle and Technicon. So all those patents that haven't yet expired, patents with a lifespan of 20 years, and all the patents that haven't yet expired, but those were providing in Technicon. The large balance of those patents were disarmed. There are some that were sourced from institutions like the Medical Research Council, one or two from MinTech, and that type of thing, but all those, the formal revenue sharing agreements were in place that determine how, when, and if they're earning their royalties, that will be split between the institution that was the original inventor and the technician. But all those patents now reside within the CSR in practice.
Part of the act specifically requested 12 months reporting, you know, from boards, etc. Are you satisfied that from that period, maybe even going back to the shareholding transfer into IDC, that there's adequate reporting of financial statements by the combined Medical Electricity as called Company Systems Board, and did they exist it, or were they only after CSIR's 100% acquisition was adequate reporting taking place, as you said, it was consolidated. I just want you to know whether you have any record of the best, you know, in terms of the meetings and all the transactions that might have got there. Because if that void is there and we appear, you know, one has a horrible fear that there could be some, you know, nasty million sitting in somebody's, you know, office somewhere and benefiting from it, which would put this committee obviously at risk, you know, in making the decision to go ahead on.
Since the time that IDC became involved, there was probably more scrutiny in this country. There were 3 or 4 board members from IDC and 3 or 4 board members from CSIR meeting on a quarterly basis, and there was a comprehensive set of ministers and board packets each quarter from those meetings. I've been involved with technical for about 10 years on the board from about 10 years. I joined just before the IDC exited and has been part of everything. So for those 10 years, I can assure you that there's been more government scrutiny in that country than in any other structure in the country.
Okay, thank
you. SADCO is a body on its own with its corporate government project, right? And Technicon was 100% owned by SADCO, right? Including before and after the Ag Institute. Later on, CSIR came in to acquire the interest, the shares, and whatever. I'm just saying, what on that basis?
CSIR was the single shareholder right from the outset. And then at some stage, due to DPI and borrowing the board money, due to IDC, they become a 50% holder. And then IDC exits, and CSIR funded that repayment of their loan account together and became the 100% shareholder again. So from inception,
just remember for the
scoundrel is capable of becoming a shareholder in the corporation?
Take a body break, 5 minutes, stretch, and then see how far we go. There might be one more.